Okay, go to it.
All right. Okay, so last week, I believe Brent presented a project just upstream here on the Tolt. And then before that, I believe it was Micah and Yane talked more about sort of why we do these types of projects. I'm going to try to not spend a lot of time talking about the why. I assume you guys learned that before. I will talk a little bit about it up front, but I'm going to move relatively quickly through that so we can focus mostly on the implementation piece in terms of before construction, what do we have to do to get these things in the ground? And then during construction, what are the challenges we face actually putting them in the ground? So this is the Chinook Bend Natural Area. I'm just the project manager for that, and the ecologist sort of in charge of getting permits and doing the ecological design parts of the project. So Chinook Bend Natural Area is this bend right here. It starts at the bridge and goes through there. So just to give a little bit of context of where it actually is, the Tolt River is right here. This is the alluvial fan. The Tolt comes pretty steep gradient and dumps a lot of sediment right here. Town of Carnation is built on the alluvial fan of the Tolt River. It pushes the Snoqualmie up against this valley wall. And Chinook Bend is really the first place where it is released, the river's kind of released, and it has a chance to drop out a lot of that sediment coming down the Tolt. So that's important because that dropping out of sediment is what causes active channel migration and has done that in the past. You have all these old channel scars. This is where the river used to be in the past. And I think Micah and maybe Yanni talked a little bit why that active channel migration, the migration of the channel back and forth is what creates good, diverse habitat for fish. So that's why that's very important and why this reach is important for rearing and spawning fish. The green lines here represent revetments and levees, that basically the river's been locked in place. In the early 60s, we, King County, went in mostly along with the Corps, our partner, and pretty much put, basically said, we don't want the river to move anymore because we've got agriculture fields next to it, and we've got residential developments, and we don't want it to flood in some areas as well. So it's pretty much been tamed. Chinook Bend, again, down here, the whole river through this whole reach is locked in place with the exception of a few places where it's allowed to sort of migrate at a natural rate. So just a little bit of terminology. I don't know if anybody covered this. A levee, I'm going to talk a lot about levees and revetments. There is a difference. The levee is a raised surface above the natural floodplain. A revetment is typically just rock below the natural floodplain, and it's keeping the river from migrating laterally, eroding the banks, versus a levee is actually containing water. This is a levee. This is actually the Chinook Bend levee being built in the late the early 60s. It's much easier for these guys to build it than it is for us. Like these guys just went out with tractors and bulldozers on a Saturday and said, hey, let's build a levee. Maybe not quite that easy, but for us to undo what they did takes a lot more effort, especially given today's regulatory environment and endangered species and such. So this is a revetment. It's rock along the bank below the floodplain surface that keeps the river from migrating laterally. So this is Chinook Bend in 1936. You can see it's already been forested for agriculture purposes. They took all the trees off, but there's no revetments in place or levees in place along this area right here. There's a little bit of a levee along this side, but you have a lot of sediment deposition throughout the whole area, channel splits. All the good stuff that Micah likely talked about is in the channel here. You've got a lot of different types of habitat, off-channel, side-channel, backwater. But it doesn't look all that different than this environment here on the Queets River on the peninsula. So you've got a real complex channel. In 1964, the levee and revetment were put in place here. You can see already we're starting to get a more simplified channel form, and that's primarily because you've got a fire hose coming through here at high flow. It's pumping all the sediment and water through here, very high energy, so it's not able to deposit as much sediment. And by from 1970 to present, basically, this has been the channel line. You have a simple, single-thread channel with the exception of one split down towards this end where it does have a chance to release a little bit. So this is showing all the revetments on the site. It's all the way around here and the levees. And this is all the way here and down here. And the project is to basically remove these on site. We own this 60-acre piece in County. We've owned it for 10 years. So the goal is to restore riverine processes and habitat throughout this reach in the Chinook Bend Natural Area. We want to allow the channel to move laterally. We want to allow it to flood onto its floodplain at an earlier flood stage, so it floods maybe at an annual flood event versus a 15-year event. And of course, the objective overall is to restore salmon spawning and rearing habitat, and also restore diverse native plants. So just again, real quickly, I'll touch on it. The patchwork of habitat types that Micah talked about, it's the river moving back and forth that causes that type of habitat. And that's what we're trying, that process, those processes that go along with the river moving back and forth is what we're trying to restore at Chinook Bend. So we get more than just, all we have right now is a relatively degraded main stem habitat. We want more secondary channels like that, just backwater areas, more off-channel areas, because that's where fish reside during flood events. It's where most fish, if you go out and snorkel a stream right now, which we did last week, you find almost all the fish, juvenile salmon, are sitting in negligible velocity. They're not out in the main stem. You'll see steelhead out there. They're in these protected habitats, especially during floods. The other objective I'll talk quite a bit about is not increasing risk to public infrastructure and private property. That's probably one of our most important objectives. If we cause a bridge to fall down or cause somebody's property to erode through one of these major manipulations, it's going to be really difficult to do the next one. So we have to be very careful, especially as a public agency, to not increase risk. So we've got two projects here. The first one was really in to prepare the floodplain for more frequent overbank flow with the debris and the sediment that goes along with it. And the second project is actually, we did that in 2008. The second project is the actual removal of the levee and the revetments. And we did phase one of that in 2009. Phase two will be done in 2011, hopefully. A lot of stakeholders. I'm not going to talk a lot about sort of stakeholders and making everybody happy, because I think Brent touched on that last time. It is a very important part of the process, and it's actually way more difficult to satisfy all your stakeholders than it is to get permits these days, because there's been a lot of efficiencies with permits developed over the last few years. But I'm not going to talk a lot about that, because I want to get to sort of the construction and the sort of on-the-ground stuff. So phase one, this is the photo taken in 2007. You can see, got a really mature cottonwood forest down here, a pioneer bar, sort of new cottonwood and alder down here. These are all planted in the last 10 years. So your biggest tree in there is about maybe 4 inches in diameter. We're pulling out about a 10-foot wall right here with very high velocity flow going right at it with a lot of wood and sediment. So we're a little concerned about our investment here, protecting that investment. Didn't have any of the bigger structural members in that floodplain. So what we've designed is a project to install some of those bigger trees, the function of those bigger trees in sort of key areas in this area to first protect our investment in a lot of the trees by putting those sort of rows of bigger live cottonwood boles or pilings in front of existing planted vegetation to take the brunt of the force from wood hitting it during a big flood event. So the idea there is to sort of rack up a lot of wood in front of there so that you create a slow water environment in back of it, and you'll get a complex topography behind it. So that was one objective, was to kind of protect our investment. The other objective, well, this is just showing sort of where we planned at the site. We started here in 2000 when we acquired the property, and for the last 10 years we've been planting out here. But the oldest trees are kind of over here. You've got a lot of the trees in here, are 1 to 5 years old, and a lot of them are at that age where they won't just sort of bend over and pop back up. They'll bend over and uproot and be pretty much killed if you get a big tree hitting them. So this was one of the more difficult parts of the design, is deciding where and how many and how big to put these roughness elements throughout the floodplain. The levee removal is real straightforward in terms of design. You pull the levee out. I mean, it's very obvious where it is. The design footprint is very clear. The roughness design, on the other hand, was a real challenge. It was kind of fun, but it was a challenging part of the design, a really thought-provoking part of it. So these are kind of the three objectives that we had for that floodplain roughness. I talked about number three, sort of protecting existing vegetation. Number one was kind of the primary objective, and that was when we pull this rock out, the river used to be along this alignment right here, and it is very quickly going to erode back to that alignment because this is all just gravel and sand. We're not trying to stop it from migrating. We want it to migrate, but we want it to migrate at a natural rate, not some ridiculously fast rate like an agricultural field, which you see downstream here. The river can move you know, up to 200 feet a year, and it's not natural because you don't have any trees sort of slowing it down. The goal here was to put several installations throughout this area so that by the time the river got to them, there was enough wood racked up on them so that the wood racked up on the rafts, or the pilings that we put out there, would actually slow down erosion. So you end up with kind of a roughened edge here versus a straight edge. And that roughened edge has a lot of sort of pockets for habitat, and it's good for fish. And it's just better always to design with a natural analog. And a natural analog is having a forest in back of this levee, not sort of a pretty bare patch. So we're trying to reinstall the function of big trees that were not there. So this is just a design drawing showing this area. The yellow patches are actually sort of patches of pilings that we install. These are live cottonwood pilings anywhere from 4 to 24 inches in diameter. With the intent was to put them in and for those to actually grow. And some of them do grow, and it depends on sort of substrate and how much bark you take off when you put them in. But you're actually installing basically live trees, not just a bare root plant. And the red is actually some wood that we put in front of it, but with the intention of really the river moving most of the wood in. So we don't have to pay for all that wood. It's free coming downstream. This is another project I'll talk briefly about. This is a different approach of the same technique. This is called flood fencing. A lot of ag fields get debris on them during floods. This was constructed by us, or designed and constructed by us, as a fence to catch debris so that it wouldn't go onto their fields. This is a very key landowner in this levee removal project, and we worked with them because one of their concerns was by realigning the river and Chinook Bend Reach, you might have more debris on their field. So we worked with them, and they're quite happy with that. Permits, this first phase permits were very straightforward. King County grading, shoreline permit, cultural resources. We didn't have to get a core permit or Section 7 stuff. So this is implementation of that. We got caught in the middle of a snowstorm in 2008. Basically had a track hole mounted auger drilling down about 15 to 18 feet, installing those pilings. And then the track hoe installed the pilings in back of him. And one of the track hole operators was really good, didn't strip a lot of bark. The other guy was kind of a rookie and stripped a lot of bark off the piling. So that's one of the things we're looking at in terms of survival rates. So this is the big flood. Here's the levee right here. Just about a week after we finished installing the pilings, all those red lines are pointing to the pilings. You can see these here have racked up a lot of wood in one event. And this is a 10-foot wall. So the levee was in place during all this, and we still got wood over the top of it. So that's a little close-up shot of that. Sort of working and functioning the way that we had planned. This is a ground shot of the same, of this jam after the flood. So the idea of this is really to create kind of a pocket of slow water behind it where you're going to get deposition, then you're going to get seeding by early successional plants like cottonwood and alder. So this will be kind of a stable node in the floodplain, as will this. So you get kind of this island braided system or topography versus a flat ag field. And that type of topography is what you see in a natural floodplain. So this is that flood fence I told you about, and this is during the flood as it's coming down. You can see all this wood was trapped during that. This is the flood of record. It was actually 2.5 feet higher than the flood of record. And we caught all this wood, and this log very likely would have knocked a bridge downstream of it. So the landowner was very happy, and that was good because they were a critical player in phase two, which is what this is showing. So the orange lines show our revetments. So there's a rock that's preventing the river from moving. The blue area, keep skipping the wrong one, is the levee, a raised surface that's preventing water from flowing across here until the river gets up to about a 10 to 15 flood event. It's a big flood. So it's keeping it pinched in here. So that's the existing conditions. This is a graphic. It's collected from LIDAR. It's an elevation. It's all showing elevation. The orange and the red is high, and the bluer colors, the light blue and dark blue, is low. So it's just another good way to sort of see how much this is pinched. It's basically preventing water from going across this floodplain. So you've got a confined channel all the way through here, was not able to release. When we pull that out, all of a sudden the water is able to split right there. So your floodplain width goes very quickly to, you know, 5-6 times the width. Energy goes down, sediment drops out, and you start getting that channel splitting that we're talking about. So there's the levee. Just to go back a little bit, you can see the position of the orange. So that this is proposed conditions. We pull the revetment out on the upstream end all the way back to here. We had to leave some of this in to protect. This is a wetland project that was constructed. And there's a wastewater discharge into that wetland. So we were planning to pull all the revetment out, all the levee out, and all the revetment out in this stretch down here. And we've already done all the stuff up here. This is a portadam that was used during construction. I'll talk about that in a bit. So lots of hurdles to jump. I mean, this is a big river. It can move quickly. It can move dramatically. And we needed to. We didn't really want to tell it where to go and try to plan for where it was going to go. We wanted to pull the constraints out and let the river do what the river will do. But we had to understand what the bounds of that would be and what the potential was for effect on private landowners and public infrastructure. So very active channel migration zone. This image alone should raise some questions about, okay, what happens if the river cuts across here? Or what if it cuts right there and goes in there? All of a sudden, the river's going way over here. That's a huge area. And we're talking, this is 150 acres. Major realignment of flow right here. You got a private landowner on this bank. So this is the kind of thing you got to think about. But when you're going into a project, what are people going to ask when I go into that room with a landowner and say, hey, I want to pull out this. What do you think of that? They're gonna look at that. Common sense tells you that's a concern. So you need to have an answer. I think Brent talked a lot about that, probably. Anticipating questions and having reasonable answers for them rather than just saying, hey, I'm going to pull this out. Good luck. What do you think? That doesn't work, and it's very important to anticipate those questions. So this is just sort of a depiction of the various scenarios that could play out over time and the things that all would do good things from the respective habitat. So it could stay in its current channel, get more complex, have more wood. Probably unlikely, given we're pulling a major constraint. We could see what would be called a chute cutoff around the end. You see a net cutoff across the middle of the floodplain, and then you could see a full avulsion onto the other property on the other side. So these are the scenarios that we needed to model. So we had to figure out what kind of model works to do this. And this just zoomed out a little bit to show we're in pretty good shape on the right bank because the state owns that property and they want to do the same thing. This, on the other hand, is all private property, which is great that it's one landowner, but a very key landowner. If this guy's not playing ball, then you've got some problems because you've got to you have to accommodate private property interests in these projects. So we hired a guy down at UC Davis, Dr. Eric Larson, to model this because he's done this before on the Sacramento River. I'm not going to get into the details of it because it's very complex, and honestly, I don't understand some of it. But the goal of it was to really understand the potential for change downstream. So we gave him these starting scenarios of, and then said, okay, what is going to happen under these various scenarios relative to the do-nothing approach? The do-nothing approach in all these, I'm going to zoom in on this one just to talk about it. Do-nothing approach, this is what the channel would look like in 100 years. It's just locked in place. It doesn't move much at all over the existing condition. So this is one scenario where we gave him the blue line, assuming that the river would cut across that bend at some point in time. And he uses the model, which basically is based on erosion rates of various surfaces, based on whether it's forested, ag land, revetted, a lot of fluid dynamics, complex equations, and he runs a lot of scenarios, or runs it over and over again until it tells you, okay, where is it going to be in 100 years? And this is the 100 years. And the dot is where the 100-year line comes back perfectly to where the do-nothing approach is. So your area of effect is from here downstream. So you can see here it comes back relatively quickly under this given scenario. This scenario, on the other hand, this is the avulsion scenario where it pops into that right bank property, comes in quite a bit. That last dot was right here. This dot's way out here. So this area, and it shows a little bit of erosion along this bank as this river comes into this left bank. So luckily, this is not our project. We're not adjusting this, but Micah's project, the Stillwater project, will have to address the potential for erosion along that bank. So the bottom line, really, of the Larson model that we did is that none of the scenarios have showed any sort of private structures or public infrastructure that was going to be subject to channel encroachment. There might be a little bank erosion, and that landowner downstream was okay with some erosion, and we're working with them to kind of mitigate for that erosion. But no structures, like the buildings on this property, weren't going to fall into the river, at least in our lifetime. So that was the downstream effects are probably the biggest issue we had to deal with, and took a lot of time, took about a total of probably a year to get that model, get the results and process and everything. The other thing we had to do is look at the effects of channel aggradation associated with a cutoff. What if the river did cut through here? That would have to cut through, and that's a swath that's probably 18 feet deep and 300 feet wide. Where's all that sediment going to go? And this is the big issue in the Snoqualmie Valley. Is that sediment going to land up down here, land down here, and then therefore my bathtub's going to fill up faster when you get a flood? That is the issue in the Snoqualmie Valley, and everybody was very concerned. I'm not going to talk a lot about that. I'll leave it at that we did do an analysis. We looked at the consistency of that, the type of that material, the size. There was a lot of silts in the top, bigger stuff at the bottom. Some of that bigger stuff, bigger material, cobbles, gravels, will end up down in here, and will likely, the gravel bars will grow. But the end conclusion of that study was that we're not going to see flooding because the cross-section of the Snoqualmie Valley is too big. You're going to see local bank erosion, which you're seeing actually in the same location. This was the original location of this channel before this gravel bar deposit. The river moved right. It migrated right, eroded that bank to accommodate that additional gravel. So that was how we got through that. We basically said, we think the banks are going to erode. We're not going to flood you out. So that was kind of the way we got through that argument. I'm just going to quickly sort of run through a bunch of other issues here. I'm not going to focus on them. You can ask me questions about them, but there's a lot of on-site issues that we had to look at as well. That same avulsion could cause potential scour at the base of this bridge. The scour that the model predicted was only on the order of 2 feet. The footings were 30 feet deep, so we don't have to really worry about that. The other thing is it going to affect the road, which is sitting over here? So this is our primary overbank flow path, but what about this one over here? What's the potential for that to develop into an actual side channel? Here's your road. This is a side channel. This is lateral migration sort of right at it. We decided this is extremely low likelihood that it's going to go there. But the level of risk associated with any damage to this road is on the millions and millions of dollars. And so the engineers basically said there is zero tolerance from risk, even though the probability is very low. So what that ended up resulting in is we're going to put a rock revetment along that. And that's going to be, the nice thing about that is we got a lot of rock. All the rock that we're removing, we need a place to put it. This is a cheap place to put it, and we kind of kill two birds with one stone. So that's, the risk is a constant issue that needs to be addressed up front and analyzed on these projects. And that was kind of the process we went through on that issue. Another issue, sort of a risk issue, is where Solid's whole slide is saying, hey, there's another project on the site that's promoting public access, putting in a bathroom, a gravel parking lot, this is all out of the floodplain, encouraging people to come visit this site. At the same time, this is just a depiction of what it could look like if the channel cuts across it, these little Death Stars or log jams. So this could be much more hazardous from a boating perspective, from kids going out there climbing around on log jams. This is a county park, but the county builds anything. Our name tag's on it. We have a lot of liability. So our prosecuting attorney and our engine stamping engineers are very concerned about any increases to risk, especially if you got more people coming out to it. So, big issue out here. I'm going to kind of fly through this. Cultural resources, not a big issue, but we spent $20,000 on it. That's a minimum of what you're going to spend just to get through cultural resources issues on sites. Big, very time-consuming and challenging process sometimes. A lot of public outreach. The public's got to be informed every step of the way, or at the last minute they'll throw a little curveball at you. Portion of the project required pretty much every permit in the book, and that takes time as well, a lot of planning involved. But we made it. We made it to construction. Now I'm going to go through some slides, talk a little bit about construction methods. Just briefly, this is, we had to remove a lot of material, so figuring out how to move efficiently was really important. A lot of it is native gravel we didn't want to take off site, and for both cost purposes, and we want the river to sort of digest it and use it. As it would have. recently passed. So what we did here is we took that chunk of the levee and we spun it around and put it like that, basically. So now it's more of a longitudinal feature of gravel. It's an island, basically, that the river will chew away at, and it will also promote a channel split right through there, which is an old channel. We also had to divert flow. This was the biggest complication and biggest headache for me on this project, is actually moving water away from the work area. And the reason we have to do that, everybody wanted all the rock removed. This river's flowing 6 to probably actually 10 feet deep very quickly. You can't see. If you put your Traco bucket in there, you try to pull rock out, you got to sit there for 10 minutes and let it clear up. And you can't see because you've got ripples on the surface. So you can't get all the rock out unless you either remove all the water or slow the water down a lot. The other issue is we have permits require minimization of impacts on water quality. I've built a lot of projects, and I knew for a fact that if we start digging along here, we would have to stop every 10 minutes. And even with that, we put the entire river out of shape probably 2 or 3 miles downstream. We'd be getting a lot of calls. And that kind of damage, that damages your reputation with regulators for years to come. So you might get it built with a lot of complaining, but you will be the guy who made the Snoqualmie River dirty for the entire summer the next time you go to permit a project. We would have created extreme turbidity out here. So we had a lot of options, not a lot, but I guess several, considered several. The first one was sort of leapfrogging our way down by putting little barbs along that area. That would have been really difficult because we couldn't get the things out to get the, as we wanted to move the structures down, it would have been almost impossible in some areas. Second option was kind of a short barb at the top that would have deflected it a little bit, and then it would have come right back. Third option was sort of an intermediate, pretty long diversion, but just deflecting a lot of the energy off that side. And then the fourth option was the whole deal, deflecting water, basically funneling water to the right of that, all the way through the project area, and that's what we decided to do. I wish we had done that, because we had some problems with that last leg. This is what we decided to use. It's called a portadam. It's a metal frame. Put water, you stand it up, and it's pretty much self-supporting, and you lay this fabric up it, and it seals it up almost entirely. It's a very ingenious structure. There's the alignment. Those are the heights of the frames. And here's the installation. You install the frames. Lay out the tarps on land, then you drag the tarps sort of out into the river, put a lot of sand, get sandbags staged. There it is, staged, ready to deploy, basically. And there it is, deployed. So basically we're pushing the entire river off to the right so we can do the work. We're not dewatering, we're just slowing things down so we can actually see. And you'll see in the next photo, this is looking upstream, the left, you see you got pretty fast current. The right, it was just gin clear. Get the operator a pair of polarized glasses, you could see every rock in there. And we were able to remove 1,900 feet of tow rock in about 4 days with two machines. So that's a lot of material. I'm fairly confident that we would have spent probably 2 more weeks doing it the other way. It may have cost about the same the other way, because this was not cheap to put that portadam in. It cost a lot of money. So that's a debate we have going, is would you divert or would you not? But this is turbidity readings, mud readings, basically, downstream. 36 NTUs, I could go into a stream and kick it like that and you'd have 35 NTUs downstream. That's not much turbidity. The background is more like sort of in the 5 range. So we had some spikes when we were removing it, but for the most part we were really low turbidity considering the type of action we were taking. It was a very aggressive action. So here's an as-built, or this is a pre-construction photo of the site. So the area that we're working on is this area right here. And there's after construction. You see the whole graded area. The levee and all the tow rock have been removed. Those red arrows show where this next series of photos is taken from. And just look at how much of a constraint, how much water. Where I'm standing, you'd have water like 8 feet over my head to get to the top of this before it would overflow that levee and start running into this floodplain back. If this is looking towards the left bank, you take that out, that's going to overflow and start splitting at probably an annual event, about 8,000 cubic feet per second versus 45,000 CFS. That's going to have major changes in the channel. So then revegetation, most of the planting's all been done. We did this all in the last 10 years. We are going to rely on natural recruitment in all these areas, conifer underplanting in some of the higher areas, and then really intensive sort of post-disturbance. When we get a big flood, we'll go in and maintain invasive plants to allow native plants to get started. And there's our funding agencies, and That's about it.
Okay, well, I've got about 10 or 15 minutes here. Just wanted to show you, if you remember last week, I talked about why we're monitoring and the approaches that we're using in terms of an experimental design. And today, I wanted to show you some actual examples of data and how we use that data to answer specific questions. So I thought I'd start out with an example of a really complex system. This is something I pulled out of the New York Times today. All the factors influencing the stability of Afghanistan. And I thought, that looks a lot like an ecosystem diagram. And thankfully, we have to simplify things a little bit when we're thinking about how ecosystems respond to restoration. And so this is the simpler version of our world. We have to pick indicators that tell us something about the big picture. And those need to be sensitive to change. They also need to be measurable. So we've got a handful of different indicators here, and I'll show you examples of data from each. But you can boil them down into mostly physical and some biological responses. And one of the common threads in this collection of indicators is that we need to know something about how the physical template changes over time. And given that this is a huge area, we have to use remote sensing. And I'll show you examples of how the remote sensing technology that's available to you now has really matured to the point that it's useful. But it can't replace everything, and so we do have to combine remote sensing with field surveys. The remote sensing that I'm referring to really is supported primarily by laser mapping. And we've got data over 1,800 acres that give us elevations of the surface at plus or minus 30 centimeters in precision. We also take orthophotos, which is basically a photographic map of the environment. And those are really high-resolution pictures. Each pixel is about 6 inches on the ground. We have also collected bathymetry, which is just the elevations of the stream bed a little over 3 miles, and then on the Tolt River, about 70 cross-sections. So I'll show you how we connect those two data sources. And we're using oblique photos for floodplain connectivity, and we're also using historical aerial photos as another form of remote sensing. So this is another colorful map like Dan showed. This is actual data and more than just a pretty picture. And what you're seeing here is actually a seamless elevation map of everything in that area with the water and a vegetation stripped off. And this allows us to really track three-dimensional changes over time as the river hops around. We can track things like four different aspects of channel change. The planform, which is what it looks like from an aerial perspective, the slope of the river, the shape of the bed, and what it looks like in cross-section. That's just perpendicular to flow. And that helps us test these two hypotheses up here, which is that the aquatic and floodplain habitats will increase in number and be more diverse and complex than before the project. And it also allows us to look at channel meandering and to determine whether or not the model predictions were correct. So this is a seamless map, again, of elevations with the trees and water removed. But there's a lot of other data that we get from the laser mapping. This is a similar diagram, but instead of just showing you everything with the vegetation removed, this is now showing you the ground surface. Superimposed upon that is the treetops in black here. And I made them kind of transparent so that you can see both of them at the same time. Now, the value here is that it allows you to come up with pretty spatially explicit maps of what's actually out there on the ground in terms of the ground surfaces as well as the vegetation. Another bit of data that we get back from the laser reflection is how intense that reflection is. And some different surfaces have different reflection intensities. And water, lucky for us, shows up as very dark black. This is actually a LiDAR image showing the intensity of the reflection. And this essentially gives us X-ray vision to see through the canopy and find channels and backwaters that we wouldn't otherwise be able to pick up in an aerial photograph. And so all the blue here is a map of water bodies that I've created from the intensity of that laser reflection. So that really helps us in terms of mapping out the different aquatic habitat types. And layering the vegetation treetops over top of the ground surface elevations really helps us come up with accurate maps of the vegetation as well. And the boundaries here are very precise relative to what you'd be able to get in the field. So one of the questions that we have where this is important for us is that we expect that the projects will increase wood recruitment. And this is the hypothesis up here on the right. One of the things we need to know then is, well, how much wood is potentially in each one of these stands? So if we see a patch of forest erode, we know what that delivered to the river. We also use a lot of the remote sensing to monitor log jams and wood retention throughout the reach. And this just shows you the resolution of the data. This is some wood that's accumulated on the bar. And having the aerial photographs also allows us to map out submerged logs, which is kind of an interesting feature that you see on the Snoqualmie River. Another big question is whether or not these engineered wood structures will be stable and function as they were intended to. And so engineered wood structures here are the ELJs that Brent talked about last week. You can see them from the air here. They're pretty large. And so we are using a variety of techniques to track those. But aerial photographs are helpful in getting a big picture view of what's happening. One of the critical hypotheses is, as Dan mentioned, the floodplain in each of these areas will become more frequently and broadly inundated and look more like this for more of the year. And so you might hypothesize, big fat fingers here. You might hypothesize that the area available to fish before the levees came out would decrease and decrease and decrease as the discharge is going up because the slow water margins get thinner and thinner near the banks. But that at some point it tips over, spills over the bank, and there's a big increase in the amount of slow water area that's available. Well, by taking out the levee, that means that tipping point is reached at a lower flow elevation. So that means that area is available more frequently throughout the year. So we'll be tracking that in part with oblique aerial photos in which we scramble a helicopter in response to high flow events and take downward looking photos and use that with known landmarks to map out where the water was. That's not something, obviously, that you can easily get from field work, so we have to rely on aerial photos for that. But there's other things, as I mentioned, that we have to do field work with in order to get the data. So we're doing field work on sediments and wood to supplement the aerial photos that we're taking. We're mapping out slow water habitats, catching juvenile fish, locating spawning adults that are constructing reds or nests in the river, and also looking at tree regeneration and the extent of Japanese knotweed, which is a particularly nasty weed that's taking over the riparian areas. So here's an example of Dan mapping out slow water habitat on the Chinook Bend site. We take a velocity meter, which is just a little propeller on a measuring device, and a GPS, and we actually walk through the site tracking where the breakpoint is between fast water and slow water. And that changes over different flow levels, and so we do it at a low flow, a medium flow, and a higher flow. And it gives us maps like this. So the red shows you the slow water area available to fish at one flow, and the blue shows you the slow water area available to fish at another flow. So you can see not only does the area change, but the location and distribution of that habitat changes. We really want to know, how does the project affect where and when that habitat appears? Sediment tells you a lot about the energy environment in a river, and by doing these projects, we really have strong effects on the energy environment. So we need to get out there and track changes in the sediment, essentially the rocks in the stream bed. And we do that by repeating a methodology that was used back in 1989 by Derek Booth when he was at King County. And we actually track consistent locations at gravel bars up and down the river, and that tells you about what's moving along the bed and how the projects might affect that. And the hypothesis is that sediment texture will become more patchy near the restoration sites because we'll have more complicated hydraulics than what currently exists, but that the spawning substrates for the fish will be protected and won't really change in terms of their overall availability. So this is really really fun field work because we get to hop in a raft and drift downstream, hopping out at every bar and taking a unbiased sample of the pebbles that are there and measuring each one of them to create a distribution curve. And you look at the center of that distribution curve, and that's called the D50. It's essentially the median. And that tells you something about the energy environment of the river at that point. One of the interesting things that you see about the Snoqualmie River is that below each of the confluences that are delivering the gravel, there are these big gravel conveyor belts, you find that the diameter of the rocks is pretty big, and that as you go downstream, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller because the river is sorting through the small pieces, moving those downstream until it can't carry them anymore, and they fall out. And same with our control site, which is where the raging river enters the stream, and you see the same pattern. So what we're really looking for is a shift in the size distribution at a given location over time. And you'll see three different colors here. The black dots show you the diameter distributions back in 1989, and then we've got 2008 and 2009 data. So it's been pretty consistent over time. So we've looked at floodplain dynamics, channel geomorphology and dynamics, wood, fish habitat, fish spawning, substrate. There's another key ingredient here that tells us, a key indicator that tells us how that site's responding to the restoration, and that's whether or not trees are naturally regenerating. And that's important because, as Dan mentioned, that was a design outcome that was intended to occur, where a lot of gravel bars were left open with the assumption that the trees would just naturally seed there. And so we're doing that with a combination of ground surveys as well as aerial photographs. But I just want to give you a sense for why we need to combine remote sensing with the field surveys. And here is Dan and I mapping slow water habitat, and there's our boat. So this is really a fundamentally different kind of monitoring than what you would do in a weightable stream survey. And so we've had to really come up with some integrated techniques, some new techniques that aren't really used all that often in stream monitoring projects. And so this is an important process, kind of a learning process for us as well. So not only are we doing the monitoring, but we're also paying close attention to how we can improve the monitoring over time as more of these projects get done. I mentioned knotweed, a nasty weed. This is a willow here on the left. This is a knotweed cluster on the right. This is a really aggressive invasive that essentially has the effect of, once it's established, preventing anything else from establishing. So if the knotweed gets established on these bare alluvial surfaces first, it's going to push out the trees that you want to have growing there so that you have a really stable stand of knotweed over time. So we want to make sure that not only to just keep our finger on the pulse of the knotweed to determine whether or not it's expanding in its range, but we also want to be able to test the effectiveness of our various treatment methods. And so we're mapping that in the field as well as from aerial photographs. So this is one of the things that working in a modified environment can also make or break the project success. So here's where we're at right now. We've collected 2009 and some 2008 baseline surveys. We have funding secured for 2010. We're going to go out and redo the bathymetry and LIDAR, but nature being what it is, it's variable. We got a really, really low flow year this year, and we've had almost no high flows to really rework the channel. So we're saving that money and spending it next year, presumably if we get a bigger flood. So I don't have any post-project data to share with you quite yet. And we're still analyzing the data. As I mentioned, I think in the previous previous talk that I gave last week, it's one thing to get the funding for the data, it's another thing to collect it, and then the analysis is something you also have to plan for as well. So I mentioned we're kind of thinking more about how to improve monitoring over time, and one of the ways that we're doing that is by partnering with other groups and agencies that are monitoring large river restoration projects and trying to cross-pollinate as best we can. I think we need to make the assumption that this is still in flux. We're still kind of learning about how to do this most cost-effectively and make sure that we've got the right indicators. So we're working with some state agencies as well as nonprofits on that. And I was going to I wanted to end today's talk on a slide that shows you how we're synthesizing all this information, and I think that's a bit premature, because what I want to really leave in your mind today is the outcome that we're after with not only the projects, but the monitoring, is that we're really trying to, over time, implement projects in a way that we learn from them, and so that we're able to shift the distribution of effectiveness further toward the right, so that over time we're building better and better projects and making more and better use of the funding that we have. And so to do that, you really have to take a careful approach to try to learn from what you're doing. And that's all I have. So I think we have about 3 minutes for questions. So thank you. I also wanted to just mention that we'll leave contact. I guess you guys have our contact information. If any of you want to follow up with further questions about methodologies or projects, feel free to, that's okay if I say, talk to Bob, and you can pass our contact information along. You can reach Dan and I outside of class, too.
So you guys, like,
monitoring
the guidance for the
lecture? We did. I mean,
Repeat the question.
Question was, did we modify any of the revetments on the outside of the bend? And I would, because of the tendency of the river, obviously the rivers tend to migrate more on the outside bends, I would say the Chinook Bend site is an outside bend until you get to the sort of tip of the peninsula. Then the other bank is clearly revetted. And there is this project that Micah talked about is just downstream of Chinook Bend, and the proposal is to remove as much of the end of that revetment as possible to allow it to access that property downstream. But the upstream portions of the right bank, where it's actually mostly an inside bend until it gets to the end, is probably off limits because of private property, unless we get an acquisition. I mean, we're always trying to acquire more property, and in the future, you know, maybe that property owner will want to sell. But we've got some other issues in the very agriculturally oriented valley where we have to demonstrate any property that we take and we put into restoration, we have to demonstrate a benefit to agriculture, which is a real challenge. So those pieces of floodplain land that we own now are really critical, and the future ones are going to be more expensive. So. Okay. Yeah, they're pretty strict. Are there any rules and regulations in place to prevent current landowners from putting in more? I would say the rules and regulations are pretty strict. To do any water work in water, like all the stuff that we're talking about, you have to get, you know, 6 or 7 different permits. And putting rock in rivers, unless it's a public safety, a direct, immediate public safety threat to a road, it's pretty difficult to get new revetments permitted. It's possible. It is, and it does happen, but it's usually an imminent threat to property, a structure, or a road, or a bridge, or something.
Yeah, I think I remember one, not necessarily on the same river, but further upstream. There's a little fishing easement, some private landowner mm-hmm. has a little easement right there, and it seems like there's some new revetments that have been built in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering about that stuff.
Sometimes that happens in the cover of darkness, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not always
night.
Legal.
Yeah. Oh, this one was definitely legal. It was a big one. Okay. All those years and everything.
I mean, I shouldn't say that, because we are building levees and revetments. King County, we have a separate sort of group within our division that is in charge of flood protection. And in certain areas, certain key areas, we're justified. It's not typically extending the footprint, but sometimes you're increasing the height, or typically it's repairs that we're doing. I don't know that of any construction of new levees or revetments. Levees in particular.
That's it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.